From? No, you guys are not allowed to answer. You guys are not allowed to answer.
How come we do know we're not allowed to answer?
Because she says, how come when I do know I'm not allowed to answer? Because I gave you the answer this morning at breakfast. We did this, but Kim had an Irish sweet bread with minty frosting for breakfast. It was really good, and yeah, the tablecloth was all green. All the cups and everything were green. So we had a fun St. Patty's Day here. What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and so yeah, my name is Kelly. Her maiden name is Collins. So she just brought more Irish into the family, right? Because actually, most of my family is German. In fact, I have Amish in my lineage. I think it's my great grandpa on my mother's side. Yeah, that's why this. Yeah, but I do. I get it all the time. People ask, "Are you Amish?" Especially when I wear my straw hat. If I wear my straw hat around, that's right. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Got to have. Yep. Oh man. Yeah, I guess it doesn't help when I go around barefoot in the summer with my straw hat on. It must look something like that. But all right, so where is St. Patrick? Obviously, he's known for being in Ireland, but where was he born? In the 4th century. It actually was England. His parents were British. So many celebrate St. Patrick's Day on March 17th and hang pictures of shamrocks and mythical creatures called leprechauns. I hope, by the way, you're not getting into the leprechaun thing and right, hanging pictures of evil little demons and impish spirits around your house. It's probably not a good idea. But who was St. Patrick, and why do we celebrate his life on this day? Why do we celebrate St. Patrick's Day, Eldon? I thought you were going to say it's just another excuse for Irish people to drink. Right? Do you know what the difference between an Irish wedding and an Irish funeral is? There's one less drunk at the Irish funeral. That's bad. Shouldn't say those things. Oh, yeah, yeah, that accent, yeah. Go ahead, Gene.
I love their singing.
Oh, yeah, very energetic, isn't it?
Very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Sometimes
it's on the computer, something like they had three tenors from Ireland. Mm-hmm, yep. One of my favorite artists, and we've sung a few of his songs, Robin Mark, is from Ireland. He leads the worship in his church in Belfast. And so when you go to listen to a concert to Robin Mark, it's a lot of fun. What's that? Days of Elijah, right. My song is Love Unknown. That's Robin Mark. We sang one last week in The Beauty of Holiness. We do a lot of Robin Mark songs, but he's a lot of fun. So you go to his concerts and, well, it's very good to see you all here. And thanks for coming. Yeah, there is a fable about him driving the snakes out. Yep. Actually, St. Patrick left us an autobiography called Confessions. So you can look it up on your Amazon Kindles. You probably get it for free. A lot of classic works are available for free on Amazon Kindle. Or go to the library and see if they have a copy of St. Patrick's Confession. But here's his life story. It says he was born in Britain in the 4th century A.D. So that'd be the 300s A.D. During a time of great uncertainty for the Roman Empire. The Roman legions that once protected civilized Britain from barbaric invaders were called away to defend themselves in other regions of the Roman Empire, and Britain was left vulnerable to attacks. Just before Patrick turned 16 years old, he and his family spent time at their holiday villa by the sea, located outside the town of Benanaventa, Bernier, when Irish pirates attacked just before dawn. Some say the villa was attacked during the day while Patrick played on the beach. Although Patrick's family escaped, Patrick and many of the family's workers did not. And soon they were en route to Ireland, where Patrick was sold as a slave to Miluic of Slemic, a druid tribal chieftain. I'm probably butchering these names, by the way. Okay, Patrick was given the task of a herdsman. And though he was raised in a Christian home because his father was a civil magistrate and a tax collector, as well as a church deacon, Patrick never made a decision to follow Christ until he was kidnapped and made a slave. In his autobiography, Confessions, Patrick wrote, "The Lord opened my senses to my unbelief, so that, though late in the day, I might remember my many sins, and accordingly I might turn to the Lord my God with all my heart." He also wrote about how his faith in God grew as he prayed to him while he shepherded the flocks. He writes this, "But after I had come to Ireland, it was then that I was made to shepherd the flocks day after day. And as I did so, I would pray all the time, right through the day. More and more, the love of God and fear of him grew strong within me. And as my faith grew, so the Spirit became more and more active. In snow, in frost, in rain, I would hardly notice any discomfort, and I was never slack, but always full of energy. It is clear to me now that this was due to the Spirit within me." Patrick's devotion to God did not go unnoticed. He soon earned the nickname Holy Boy among his fellow slaves. And my guess is they didn't mean that endearingly. One night, Patrick had a dream. In it, he heard a voice telling him, "Soon you will be returning to your own country." In another dream, he received a response to the first dream, being told, "Come and see where your ship is waiting for you." At the age of 22, so he's been a slave for 6 years, Patrick escaped, traveled 200 miles to the coast of Ireland. Of his long journey across Ireland, he wrote, "I turned on my heel and ran away, leaving behind the man to whom I had been bound for 6 years. Yet I came away from him in the power of God, for it was he who was guiding my every step for the best. So I felt not the least anxiety until I reached the ship." As he approached one of the men on the ship that rested on the coast, and when he asked to board, the seaman scowled at him. So Patrick started to leave. But the man called back to him, saying the other passengers wanted him on board. Patrick wrote, "In spite of this, I still hope that they might come to have faith in Jesus Christ." That journey by boat was long, including a stop where they journeyed on land for 28 days. After having run out of food, the captain turned to Patrick and challenged him to ask his God for more. Glad to oblige, Patrick responded, "Turn trustingly to the Lord, who is my God, and put your faith in him with all your heart, because nothing is impossible to him. On this day, he will send us food sufficient for our journey, because for him there is abundance everywhere." And according to Patrick's autobiography, when the men turned around, a herd of pigs was standing before them. They feasted for days and gave thanks to God. I joked with the kids this morning, say they were on land. It wasn't that the pigs were running across the water. That would have been something, right? A bunch of crates of bacon go floating by from a previous shipwreck. Yeah. 2 years later, Patrick finally made it to his beloved Britain and into the arms of his mother and father, who pleaded with him never to leave them again. Patrick began to settle back into his life in Britain, and he studied to become a priest and a bishop. But one night, Patrick had a dream of a man who seemed to come from Ireland and was carrying a letter with the words, "The Voice of the Irish." As Patrick began to read the words, he seemed to hear the voice of the same men he worked with, as if they were shouting, "Holy broth of a boy, we beg you, come back and walk once more among us." But the church leaders and Patrick's parents fiercely opposed his plans to return to Ireland. They did not think the Druids were worth saving. His family shuddered at the thought of him returning to barbaric Ireland with the gospel, as the Druids were known to weave criminals and runaway slaves into giant wicker baskets and suspend them over fire. Of this opposition, Patrick later wrote, "So at last I came here to the Irish Gentiles to preach the gospel, and now I had to endure insults from unbelievers, to hear criticism of my journeys, and suffer many persecutions, even to the point of chains. And should I prove worthy, I am ready and willing to give up my own life without hesitation for his name. There was always someone talking behind my back and whispering, 'Why does he want to put himself in danger among his enemies who do not know God?'" Patrick had to sell his title of nobility to become the slave of Christ, serving the barbaric nation. While he was in Ireland, Patrick shared the gospel with his former slave owner, Miluic, the Druid. Instead of turning his back on his pagan gods, Miluik locked himself in his house and set it on fire, while Patrick stood outside and pleaded with him to turn to Christ. It is said that Miluik drowned out Patrick's pleas by crying out to his false gods. His refusal to hear the gospel was just the beginning of Patrick's challenges with the Druids as he spread the good news across Ireland and taught its people how to read and write. One story that some believe is legend mentions Patrick challenging the Druid wizards in 433 on the vernal equinox, which occurred on Easter Sunday that year. Patrick challenged the wizard's power of control by starting a bonfire, which was central to the Druids' ritual, on a hillside opposite of the barbaric idol worshippers. Patrick was dragged before the Druid council, where he had the opportunity to share about Jesus, the light of the world. And while some of the Druids believed, others tried to kill him. Patrick continued his journey across Ireland. He preached at racetracks and other places of worldly indulgences, seeing many come to Christ. However, this was not without opposition. The Druids often tried to poison him. One time, a barbarian warrior speared Patrick's chariot driver to death in an attempt to kill Patrick. He was often ambushed at his evangelistic events and was enslaved again for a short time. He had to purchase safe passage through a hostile warlord's land to continue on his journey. Another time, Patrick and his companions were taken as prisoners and were going to be killed, but they were later released. In his confessions, Patrick wrote, "As every day arrives, I expect either sudden death or deception, or being taken back as a slave or some other such misfortune. But I fear none of these, since I look to the promise of heaven and have flung myself into the hands of the all-powerful God who rules as Lord everywhere." Patrick journeyed throughout Ireland, sharing Christ until his death on March 17th, around the year 461. Later, Irish mythological creatures known as leprechauns would creep into the holiday celebration, as well as the symbol of the shamrock, which was believed to have been used by Patrick to illustrate the Trinity as he preached and taught. Some legends have circulated stating Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland. Since there are no snakes in Ireland, and snakes often symbolize the devil and evil, many believe the snakes were a metaphor representing his work of driving the idol-worshipping Druid cult out of the country. So that's the story of St. Patrick. Now you know. Gene.
You didn't mention kissing the Blarney Stone.
I didn't. I don't know what that's about, kissing the Blarney Stone. Eldon?
You can still do that.
Oh, my brother-in-law did it.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it's still
happening. Mm-hmm. And his wife still kisses him, so yeah. It's a moldy stone. I don't understand, but that's supposed to bring good luck. Eldon.
Well, I understood from that it was sort of a deal where the Queen of England wanted to conquer this certain castle over there, and it wasn't that important, but the Queen wanted it done. But anyway, the guy with and then one thing led to another, and then the Blarney Stone came into being. That's one of the most foolish things I think that anybody can do. You lay a person on their back, and you got handrails in their mouth so you don't fall.
Yeah.
And you kiss the highest stone in this big arch.
Yeah. After all them lips been on it.
That's why,
yeah, the alcohol cleanses them, right? What's that, Hannah? Go ahead. Yeah, partly, but. Well, England had lived.
They sound like they were fierce, bad stuff they were doing, but I just wonder how they got that.
Because they were. Any time you have an absence of the Word of God in a place, it becomes very barbaric. It becomes cruel. It becomes harsh. You know, the Roman Empire was what we typically call a civilized place, but even it was harsh and barbaric. Throwing the gladiatorial combats they used to have, the throwing people, the animals just to watch things get killed. It got pretty severe. And it really was the gospel going throughout Europe that transformed all of these what we call barbaric tribal peoples into civilizations. Western civilization, the study of Western civilization is the study of the spread of Christianity throughout Europe and the Western world.
The Crusades start in the
1100s. I think 1099, 1097 was the first crusade. Yep. So, okay, well, we've got the history of St. Patrick, so I don't know if you're ready for any more history here, but let's turn to, in your Bibles, to 2 Kings as we look at Ahaz the Terrible. Ahaz the Terrible. You might want to put yourself a finger in another place, and that is 2 Chronicles 28. We're going to be going back and forth between these, and we'll probably not get this done tonight, but that's okay. Yeah, so put one finger in 2 Chronicles 28. We're going to turn there a couple of times, but our main text is going to be 2 Kings. Yeah, 2 Chronicles chapter 28 and 2 Kings chapter 16. So I want to review very quickly here. If I'm scrolling back in our timeline, hopefully you'll remember some of these names. Obviously, everybody in the north, good or bad, as far as kings go. Bad. They're all evil men. How about in the south? If and if, right? So if we go back all the way to Joash, remember the boy King Joash? They put him on the throne when he's 8 years old after Athaliah was killed. So Joash, good guy or bad guy? Good guy in the beginning, right? And then toward the end of his reign, he had some trouble. His son Amaziah takes the throne. What about Amaziah? Kind of the same thing, right? Good in the beginning, but toward the end, he starts to slack off a little bit. How about Uzziah? Yeah, he's the one that was turned into a leper, because what did he try to do? Not a leopard, by the way. Right, he tried to offer incense in the sanctuary. He tried to take the priest's role of offering incense, and so God punished him with leprosy. So Uzziah, another one that started off really well, but by the end of his reign, he's getting some bad thinking going on there. His son Jotham takes the throne. Jotham, good guy, bad guy?
Good.
He was a good guy, yeah. He was a faithful guy. He actually didn't slack off in the end of his reign. So we have several generations here of godly kings, or mostly godly kings, and we come to this guy named Ahaz. And 2 Kings 16:1 says, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. He did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. What's that epitaph tell you?
Very bad.
Yeah, very bad. What was the way of the kings of Israel? Idolatry, the idol worship, right. So Ahaz is actually going to join the northern kingdom in their idolatry, which is going to be interesting considering what we're going to read here about the northern kingdom. Now, the northern kingdom, we have this fella named Pekah, the son of Remaliah. And he's on the throne for 20 years. And if you count things out or just look up at the chart, you can see that there's only about a 3-year overlap between Ahaz and Pekah, the son of Remaliah. So that's going to give us a good narrow window to look at some of the events that happened during Ahaz's reign. We are now at the year 742 BC. That tells us we're getting close to a major event. So what is the major event that occurs in 722? Not the Babylonian captivity, but the Assyrian captivity. Who goes into captivity to Assyria? The northern kingdom. Right, so we are only 20 years away from that destruction of the northern kingdom of the nation of Israel. So, Ahaz comes on the throne in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah. Pekah only rules 20 years, so we've only got 3 years of overlap here. Let's look at some of the things that Ahaz does. Why does God say he did not do right in the eyes of his God? Verse 3, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. So, how far into this idolatry thing is Ahaz?
Worse than
Ahab. Yeah, he's worse than Ahab. This guy's worse than the kings of Israel. Because they worshipped the golden calves. At least they called those things Jehovah, even though it wasn't. But he's just completely abandoned the worship of Jehovah God in the southern kingdom. And we'll see, it's going to go even farther than that. But he takes up this horrible practice that he learned from the nations around Israel. And that was, if you were really devoted to your God, you gave him the most valuable thing. Right? I mean, does that make sense? If you're really devoted to God, you want to give him what you think is valuable. But not your kid? But isn't that one of the most valuable things you have? You're not going to sacrifice him, though. Yeah. What's that? God did. So we should? Uh-huh. But doesn't that get to the heart of the problem? Because underneath that whole entire idolatrous practice, and underneath really every false religion in the world, is the idea of human merit. Right? I offer to God something that proves my devotion, something that proves my worthiness, something that is valuable to me, and I'm going to give it over to God. Whether it's a sacrifice of a bull or money or time, or whatever it is, if I'm offering that to God as a symbol of how deserving I am of this God's favor, then why wouldn't I give the most valuable thing I've got? If I really want him to do what I need him to do, then I'm going to show my devotion in the most crazy ways possible. And one of the nations, especially the Moabites, like to do this. The Ammonites did too, but they would construct a large metal statue of their god. Molech was one of them. Chemosh was the god who really liked children. And its arms would be held out like this, and they would set a fire below it till the thing was hot, and then they would cast the young infant into the arms of the statue until it burned up. And it was a horrible thing. I mean, even God himself describes this as an abominable practice. It was horrible. But that's what these people were doing to try to prove their devotion to these gods. And this is where it leads them. Does your theology impact your practice? Absolutely. Does your view of God dictate how you're going to behave? Absolutely. So is theology ever not practical? No, not really. All theology is practical because your view of God determines how you're going to live out. I like Kevin Swanson said it this way: what you fear is what you worship. You will worship whatever you think can alleviate your fear. Right? So if you're afraid of military powers like Ahaz was, then you're going to worship a God that you think is going to be able to cure that. If you're afraid of being poor, you're going to worship a God that you think can make you rich. Whatever you're afraid of, you're going to worship a God that you think can take care of that. So, what's the biblical conception, what are we supposed to be afraid of? Well, we are supposed to be afraid of something. It's not nothing. God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And why am I afraid of Him? Because He has control. And someday, I have to stand in front of Him and give an answer, don't I? And if I recognize that my life doesn't line up with His righteous standards, that should strike terror in me to say that I have to answer to a holy God and I'm not holy. Well, if I am afraid that the God that I'm worshiping is not happy with me, then how am I going to prove my devotion and change His mind? Well, their thinking was, we'll offer Him the most valuable thing you've got, your son. And so they throw the son in there, devour it, burn it up, and they think that appeases their God, make that God happy, make that God act on your behalf. But we are commanded not to sacrifice our children, because who already had the plan to do so? The Father did. All right, when did God the Father and the Son concoct this plan to save us? Before the foundation of the world, right? Before the world was ever even created, the Father and the Son had already agreed that the Son would sacrifice Himself for the sins of the world. So, me trying to offer my Son to appease God of His wrath against me is an absolute abomination. It's an affront to Christ. It's an affront to God's plan to save the world through His Son. It's trying to say that my act of sacrifice could somehow match Christ's act of sacrifice. And that is what is wicked. That's what's abominable about it. God gives us children to treasure them, to nurture them, to raise them, to teach them to fear God as well, not as a means to appease Him somehow. And so, but this is Ahaz the Terrible. Now, obviously, probably he sacrifices his firstborn son. So what is that going to tell us about Hezekiah? Probably not the oldest son, right? But I guess at least Hezekiah didn't grow up with mom and dad saying, how come you couldn't be more like your older brother? Oh, wait, he's not here. So here's what's going on. Ahaz is responding to the difficulties and trials of his kingdom by turning away from God and turning towards the idols of the nations around him. And we're going to look at some of the other things that happened. Verse 5 of chapter 16. Then Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahab. So we only have 3 years of overlap here. That gives us a pretty good timing of when this battle takes place. It's got to be within the first 3 years of Ahaz's reign, because Pekah is going to pass away very, very soon. So Pekah is the son of the is the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. Rezin is the king of who? Syria. The Syrians. Do you remember it wasn't that long ago that Jeroboam II reduced Syria to a vassal state? Now they've got a king again, and they're partnering up with the northern kingdom to attack the southern kingdom. So they've ganged up on the southern kingdom of Judah. But what does it tell us about this siege to Jerusalem? They could not conquer him. They couldn't overcome him. Boy, wouldn't you like to know more about that battle? How come they couldn't overcome him? What happened? This is one of the fun instances where God does give us more information. So I want you to turn to 2 Chronicles. Sometimes the Lord gives us statements like that in the books, and He doesn't fill us in on anything else because we didn't need to know it. But apparently we needed to know this. So, the first four verses of 2 Chronicles 28 read pretty much like the first four verses of the book of Kings. Except it tells us that in verse 2, he even made metal images for the Baals, and he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom and burned his son on the offering. So a little bit more detail there into his idolatrous practices. According to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel, and he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. So those statements tell us pretty much what we already knew about Ahaz. He's a wicked king. He's chasing after the gods that Jehovah already defeated and drove out from the land. Go ahead, Patricia. Really? Okay, are you reading, what version do you have? The evidence, okay. And the King James says children?
Yes, it does. It says, moreover, he burned incense to the valley, the son of
Hinnom,
and burned his children.
Ah, okay, okay. Isn't that interesting? Okay, my translation says sons, so the plural's there, and I missed it. Fantastic. Not for him. But wow, wow. Not just once, but at least twice. Yeah, he sacrifices his children. Aren't you glad we don't sacrifice our children today? Or do we? Yeah, I'm going to go there, right? Are there still people sacrificing their children to idolatrous gods today? Well, yeah, some people don't take the responsibility to raise them, and that's a serious offense. But you know what? There's also the God of convenience and ease, and we are slaughtering children by the millions in America. Eldon. Yep, that's the same thing I was thinking of. Abortion. No, and we're making it more legal and easier here in Illinois. That is a worship of a god. It's the god of self. It's the god of, I don't want to have to spend the time pouring my life into this other individual. I don't want to have to spend my money. It's expensive to raise kids, isn't it? You know what the latest estimates are? I laugh at this because it's not true at all. But the latest estimates are $250,000 to raise a child. Yeah, $250,000 to raise a child from birth to 18 years old. Oh, absolutely wrong. Yeah, what's that? Not a million. I'm going to spend millions. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've checked. You know what they go for on eBay? No, I'm kidding. Eldon, go ahead. That's right, yeah. You do get bulk discounts, right? Was it? Mm-hmm. It is. It's just as much of an abomination to have these things happening, and we keep voicing it. We keep trying to tell people the truth about this, but rather than having metal statues where people throw their children in, they're just slaughtering them in the womb and calling it a procedure. And so millions of kids are dying for the same reasons. We're worshiping the god of self. We're worshiping the god of financial freedom. We're worshiping the god of career. We're worshiping the god of whatever. But you worship the god of the Bible. And what does he tell us about children? Children are heritage. They're an inheritance from the Lord. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. Right. Well, Ahaz obviously doesn't believe that.
This thing about the King James saying children.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether it's not talking about he's the king, so his children could be considered.
Oh, just any member of the kingdom?
Yeah, that's what I'm wanting to talk about. I don't know if
it's. Well, that's an interesting thought, but off the top of my head, I'm not aware of any instance where the term sons is used that way for the kings of Israel. Maybe. I'd have to look at that one. That's interesting. Right. Let me...
Just below that, it says, the Lord has cast out before the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm. So 2 Kings, that's 2 Chronicles. Made offerings according to the abominations. He sacrificed and made offerings. Where'd it go? Oh, there it is. Burned his sons. And... Yeah. It is the word for son, Ben. And that word can get used kind of generically. Sometimes it means children, as in, like, all my kids. I could use the word Ben for all my children, even though some of them are daughters. At times, yeah, like you said, it does say the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. Yehovah. Yeah, that's the same word right there as Ben, Ben Yisrael, the sons of Israel. And so there it's just talking about the members of the nation. But, oh, that's an interesting thought. But, well, at the very least, we know that it was more than one person he was sacrificing there. I'll have to look into that one a little more. All right, let's look at what else is going on here. Sometimes we talk about this. This just occurs to me. Sometimes we talk about someone's got to hit rock bottom before they turn to the Lord. You know, just the Lord's got to pull everything out. But does that always drive people to faith? No. Sometimes it drives them to desperation. And that's what Ahaz is going to do here. Verse 5, therefore the Lord his God gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, who defeated him, and took captive a great number of his people and brought them to Damascus. He was also given into the hand of the king of Israel, who struck him with a great force. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 from Judah in one day, all of them men of valor, because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. And Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, killed Maaseiah, the king's son, and Azrikam, the commander of the palace, and Elkanah, the next in authority to the king. The men of Israel took captive 200,000 of their relatives, women, sons, and daughters. They also took much spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. So, who wins the fight? Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, come down to Jerusalem and they besiege it. And what happens? They win. A complete victory. So why does the book of Kings tell us they were not able to overcome him?
Does it mean maybe by overcome and destroy
him? They weren't able to destroy him, okay? Possible. They took away, he kills 120,000 people and takes 200,000 captives. That's pretty serious, right?
He sort of took his country, but maybe he was still there.
Okay, so they left him alive?
I mean, you know, crops and cattle mm-hmm. and spoil.
Yep. Well, that's true. He is still reigning.
So they must have not
They don't depose him. That is very true. There's two answers to this. And one of them is what follows here. So let's keep reading. We're going to see why God says in the other book that they were not able to overcome him, even though they won the battle. Okay. So they take everything back to Samaria, all these captives, all this spoil. Verse 9. But a prophet of the Lord was there, whose name was Oded. And he went out to meet the army that came to Samaria, and he said to them, behold, because the Lord, the God of your fathers, was angry with Judah, he gave them into your hand. But you have killed them in a rage that has reached up to heaven, and now you intend to subjugate the people of Judah and Jerusalem, male and female, as your slaves. Have you not sins of your own against the Lord your God? Now hear me. Send back the captives from your relatives whom you have taken, for the fierce wrath of the Lord is upon you. So they get back to Samaria, celebrating their victory, and God sends a prophet, says, no, you stop right there. I let you defeat Ahaz to teach him a lesson, but you are not going to do this. You're not going to enslave your relatives. You're not going to destroy the southern country. And so they let him go. So, the book of Kings says he was not able to overcome him. Why not? Because God stepped in and put limits on him and said no. Not going to happen. Go ahead, Gene. Yeah. Yes, yeah, part of it was that God was not going to allow Judah to be wiped out. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, it absolutely is. There has to be a king of Judah always until Christ is born. And then he lives forever. And so now there is no threat whatsoever that the promises to David can be annulled. Right. But yes, you're absolutely right. Until this point, God has to keep Ahaz alive in order to continue on the kingly line. Okay, so, and he does. Now, for homework this week, we're out of time tonight, but for homework this week, I want you to read Isaiah chapter 7 at some point. Okay, Isaiah chapter 7. Because remember, we said Isaiah prophesies during the reign of Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz, the kings of Israel. So guess where we are? We've covered the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, and we're in the reign of Ahaz. Isaiah is writing his prophecies while this stuff happens. And Isaiah chapter 7 is a reference to this battle. Okay? So, read that this week. We'll take a look at it a little further next week. And get into some interesting discussions about it. Patricia, was there a question?
No, I'm unbelievable myself.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Any... Gene.
Well, this is just like the American Indians. There's lots of legends where they like the women jumped off the cliff because they were lost.
Yes, yeah.
And they sacrificed them to stop the famine.
Mm-hmm.
The tribe.
Oh, human sacrifice.
Like
yeah. Human sacrifice is not a new thing. It's been going on for a long time. So the thinking is, if the blood of bulls and animals is valuable to appease your God, then boy, the blood of people must be really valuable. You know, look, study the history of the Aztecs and the Mayans. It was a bloody, bloody place to live in the Americas. Any other questions? All right. Remember, what you fear is what you worship. What are you afraid of? Father, we thank you that you